coffee for herself and Harold, and had poured tea for him. He lowered himself to the sofa, and Harold to the chair to his left, and Julia to the squashed Suzani-covered ottoman facing him. The places they always sat, the low table between them, and he wished the moment would hold itself. For what if this was the last one he would have here? The last time he would sit in this warm, dark room with its books and tart, sweet scent of cloudy apple juice and the navy and scarlet Turkish carpet that had buckled itself into pleats under the coffee table and the patch on the sofa cushion where the fabric had worn thin and he could see the white muslin skin beneath. All the things that he'd allowed to grow so dear to him because they were Harold and Julia's, and because he had allowed himself to think of their house as his. For a while they all sipped at their drinks, and none of them looked at the other, and he tried to pretend that this was just a normal evening, although if it had been a normal evening, none of them would be so silent. "Well," Harold began at last, and he set his cup down on the table, readying himself. "Whatever he says," he reminded himself, "don't start making excuses for yourself. Whatever he says, accept it, and thank him for everything." There was another long silence. "This is hard to say," Harold continued, and shifted his mug in his hand, and he made himself wait through Harold's next pause. "I really did have a script prepared, didn't I?" he asked Julia, and she nodded. "But I'm more nervous than I thought I would be."
"I know," she said, "but you're doing great."
"Ha!" Harold replied. "It's sweet of you to lie to me, though," and smiled at her, and he had the sense that it was only the two of them in the room, and that for a moment they had forgotten he was there at all. But then Harold was quiet again, trying to say what he'd say next.
"Jude, we've known you for almost a decade now," Harold said at last, and he watched as Harold's eyes moved to him and then moved away to somewhere above Julia's head.
"And over those years, you've grown very dear to us, both of us. You're our friend, of course, but we think of you as more than a friend to us, as someone more special than that."
He looked at Julia, and she nodded at him once more.
"So I hope you won't think this is too presumptuous, I suppose, but we've been wondering if you might consider letting us, well, adopt you."
Now he turned to him again and smiled.
"You'd be our legal son and our legal heir, and someday all this—"
He tossed his free arm into the air in a parodic gesture of expansiveness.
"Will be yours, if you want it."
He was silent. He couldn't speak. He couldn't react. He couldn't even feel his face, couldn't sense what his expression might be. And Julia hurried in.
"Jude," she said, "if you don't want to, for whatever reason, we understand completely. It's a lot to ask. If you say no, it won't change how we feel about you, right, Harold? You'll always, always be welcome here, and we hope you'll always be part of our lives. Honestly, Jude, we won't be angry, and you shouldn't feel bad."
She looked at him.
"Do you want some time to think about it?"
And then he could feel the numbness receding, although, as if in compensation, his hands began shaking, and he grabbed one of the throw pillows and wrapped his arms around it to hide them. It took him a few tries before he was able to speak, but when he did, he couldn't look at either of them.
"I don't need to think about it," he said, and his voice sounded strange and thin to him. "Harold, Julia, are you kidding? There's nothing, nothing I've ever wanted more. My whole life. I just never thought—"
He stopped. He was speaking in fragments. For a minute they were all quiet, and he was finally able to look at both of them.
"I thought you were going to tell me you didn't want to be friends anymore."
"Oh, Jude," said Julia, and Harold looked perplexed.
"Why would you ever think that?"
he asked. But he shook his head, unable to explain it to them. They were silent again, and then all of them were smiling. Julia at Harold, Harold at him, he into the pillow, unsure how to end the moment, unsure where to go next. Finally, Julia clapped her hands together and stood.
"Champagne,"
she said, and left the room. He and Harold stood as well and looked at each other.
"Are you sure?"
Harold asked him, quietly.
"I'm as sure as you are,"
he answered, just as quietly. There was an uncreative and obvious joke to be made about how much like a marriage proposal the event seemed, but he didn't have the heart to make it. "You realize you're going to be bound to us for life," Harold smiled and put his hand on his shoulder, and he nodded. He hoped Harold wouldn't say one more word, because if he did, he would cry, or vomit, or pass out, or scream, or combust. He was aware suddenly of how exhausted, how utterly depleted he was, as much by the past few weeks of anxiety as well as the past 30 years of craving, of wanting, of wishing so intensely, even as he told himself he didn't care, that by the time they had toasted one another and first Julia and then Harold had hugged him, the sensation of being held by Harold so unfamiliar and intimate that he had nearly squirmed, he was relieved when Harold told him to leave the damn dishes and go to bed. When he reached his room, he had to lie on the bed for half an hour before he could even think of retrieving his phone. He needed to feel the solidity of the bed beneath him, the silk of the cotton blanket against his cheek, the familiar yield of the mattress as he moved against it. He needed to assure himself that this was his world, and he was still in it, and that what had happened had really happened. He thought suddenly of a conversation he'd once had with Brother Peter, in which he'd asked the brother if he thought he'd ever be adopted, and the brother had laughed.
"No," he'd said, so decisively that he had never asked again. And although he must have been very young, he remembered, very clearly, that the brother's dismissal had only hardened his resolve, although, of course, it wasn't an outcome that was his to control in the slightest. He was so discombobulated that he forgot that Willem was already on stage when he called, but when Willem called him back at intermission, he was still in the same place on the bed, in the same comma-like shape, the phone still cupped beneath his palm.
"Jude,"
Willem breathed when he told him, and he could hear how purely happy Willem was for him. Only Willem, and Andy, and to some extent Harold, knew the outlines of how he had grown up, the monastery, the home, his time with the Douglases. With everyone else, he'd tried to be evasive for as long as he could, until finally he would say that his parents had died when he was little, and that he had grown up in foster care, which usually stopped their questions. But Willem knew more of the truth, and he knew Willem knew that this was his most impossible, his most fervent desire.
"Jude, that's amazing. How do you feel?"
He tried to laugh.
"Like I'm going to mess it up?" "You won't."
They were both quiet.
"I didn't even know you could adopt someone who's a legal adult. I mean, it's not common, but you can, as long as both parties consent. It's mostly done for purposes of inheritance."
He made another attempt at a laugh.
"Stop trying to laugh," he scolded himself. "I don't remember much from when I studied this in family law, but I do know that I get a new birth certificate with their names on it."
"Wow," said Willem.
"I know," he said.
He heard someone calling Willem's name commandingly in the background.
"You have to go," he told Willem. "Shit,"
said Willem.
"But Jude, congratulations. No one deserves it more."
He called back at whoever was yelling for him.
"I've got to go," he said. "Do you mind if I write Harold and Julia?"
"Sure," he said.
"But Willem, don't tell the others, okay? I just want to sit with it for a while."
"I won't say a word.
I'll see you tomorrow. And Jude?"
But he didn't, or couldn't, say anything else.
"I know," he said. "I know, Willem. I feel the same way. I love you," said Willem.
and then he was gone before he had to respond. He never knew what to say when Willem said that to him, and yet he always longed for him to say it. It was a night of impossible things, and he fought to stay awake, to be conscious and alert for as long as possible, to enjoy and repeat to himself everything that had happened to him, a lifetime's worth of wishes coming true in a few brief hours. Back in the apartment the next day, there was a note from Willem telling him to wait up, and when Willem came home he had ice cream and a carrot cake, which the two of them ate, even though neither of them particularly liked sweets, and champagne, which they drank even though he had to wake up early the following morning. The next few weeks slid by. Harold was handling the paperwork and sent him forms to sign, the petition for adoption, an affidavit to change his birth certificate, a request for information about his potential criminal record, which he took to the bank at lunch to have notarized. He didn't want anyone at work to know beyond the few people he told, Marshall and Citizen and Rhodes. He told J.B. and Malcolm, who on the one hand reacted exactly as he'd anticipated, J.B. making a lot of unfunny jokes at an almost tick-like pace, as if he might eventually land on one that worked. Malcolm asking increasingly granular questions about various hypotheticals that he couldn't answer, and on the other hand had been genuinely thrilled for him. He told Black Henry Young, who had taken two classes with Harold when he was in law school and had admired him, and J.B.'s friend Richard, to whom he'd grown close after one particularly long and tedious party at Ezra's a year ago, when the two of them had had a conversation that had begun with the French welfare state and then had moved on to various other topics, the only two semi-sober people in the room. He told Phaedra, who had started screaming, and another old college friend, Elijah, who had screamed as well. And, of course, he told Andy, who at first had just stared at him and then nodded, as if he had asked if Andy had an extra bandage he could give him before he left for the night. But then he began making a series of bizarre seal-like sounds, half bark, half sneeze, and he realized that Andy was crying. The sight of it made him both horrified and slightly hysterical, unsure of what to do. "Get out of here," Andy commanded him between sounds. "I mean it, Jude, get the fuck out." And so he did. The next day at work he received an arrangement of roses the size of a gardenia bush, with a note in Andy's angry, blocky handwriting that read, "Jude, I'm so fucking embarrassed I can barely write this note. Please forgive me for yesterday. I couldn't be happier for you, and the only question is what took Harold so fucking long. I hope you'll take this as a sign that you need to take better care of yourself, so someday you'll have the strength to change Harold's adult diapers when he's 1,000 years old and incontinent, because you know he's not going to make it easy for you by dying at a respectable age like a normal person. Believe me, parents are pains in the ass like that. But great, too, of course. Love, Andy." It was, he and Willem agreed, one of the best letters they'd ever read. But then the ecstatic month passed, and it was January, and Willem left for Bulgaria to film, and the old fears returned, accompanied now by new fears. They had a court date for February 15th, Harold told him, and with a little rescheduling, Lawrence would be presiding. Now that the date was so close, he was sharply, inescapably aware that he might ruin it for himself, and he began, at first unconsciously and then assiduously, avoiding Harold and Julia, convinced that if they were reminded too much, too actively of what they were in fact getting, that they would change their minds. And so when they came into town for a play the second week in January, he pretended he was in Washington on business, and on their weekly phone calls, he tried to say very little and to keep the conversations brief. Every day the improbability of the situation seemed to grow larger and more vivid in his mind. Every time he glimpsed the reflection of his ugly zombie's hobble in the side of a building, he would feel sickened. Who really would ever want this? The idea that he could become someone else's seemed increasingly ludicrous, and if Harold saw him just once more, how could he too not come to the same conclusion? He knew it shouldn't matter so much to him. He was, after all, an adult. He knew the adoption was more ceremonial than truly sociologically significant. But he wanted it with a steady fervor that defied logic, and he couldn't bear it being taken away from him now, not when everyone he cared about was so happy for him, not when he was so close. He had been close before. The year after he arrived in Montana, when he was 13, the home had participated in a tri-state adoption fair. November was National Adoption Month, and one cold morning they had been told to dress neatly and had been hurried onto two school buses and driven 2 hours to Missoula, where they were herded off the buses and into the conference room of a hotel. Theirs had been the last buses to arrive, and the room was already filled with children, boys on one side, girls on the other. In the center of the room was a long stripe of tables, and as he walked over to his side, he saw that they were stacked with labeled binders. Boys, babies, boys, toddlers, boys, 4 to 6, boys, 7 to 9, boys, 10 to 12, boys, 13 to 15, boys, 15+. Inside, they had been told, were pieces of paper with their pictures and names and information about themselves. Where they were from, what ethnicity they were, information about how they did in school and what sports they liked to play and what talents and interests they had. What, he wondered, did his sheet of paper say about him? What talents might have been invented for him? What race? What origins? The older boys, the ones whose names and faces were in the 15+ binder, knew they would never be adopted, and when the counselors turned away, they snuck out through the back exit to, they all knew, get high. The babies and toddlers had only to be babies and toddlers. They would be the first to be chosen, and they didn't even know it. But as he watched from the corner he had drifted toward, he saw that some of the boys, the ones old enough to have experienced one of the fairs before, but still young enough to be hopeful, had strategies. He watched as the sullen became smiling, as the rough and bullying became jocular and playful, as boys who hated one another in the context of the home played and bantered in a way that appeared convincingly friendly. He saw the boys who were rude to the counselors, who cursed at one another in the hallways, smile and chat with the adults, the prospective parents, who were filing into the room. He watched as the toughest, the meanest of the boys, a 14-year-old named Sean, who had once held him down in the bathroom, his knees digging into his shoulder blades, pointed at his name tag as the man and woman he had been talking with walked toward the binders. "Sean," he called after them. "Sean Grady." And something about his hoarse, hopeful voice, in which he could hear the effort, the strain to not sound hopeful at all, made him feel sorry for Sean for the first time, and then angry at the man and woman, who, he could tell, were actually paging through the boys' 7 to 9 binder. But those feelings passed quickly, because he tried not to feel anything those days. Not hunger, not pain, not anger, not sadness. He had no tricks, he had no skills, he couldn't charm. When he had arrived at the home, he had been so frozen that they had left him behind the previous November, and a year later, he wasn't sure that he was any better. He thought less and less frequently of Brother Luke, it was true, but his days outside the classroom smeared into one. Most of the time he felt he was floating, trying to pretend that he didn't occupy his own life, wishing he was invisible, wanting only to go unnoticed. Things happened to him, and he didn't fight back the way he once would have. Sometimes, when he was being hurt, the part of him that was still conscious wondered what the brothers would think of him now. Gone were his rages, his tantrums, his struggling. Now he was the boy they had always wished him to be. Now he hoped to be someone adrift, a presence so thin and light and insubstantial that he seemed to displace no air at all. So he was surprised as the counselors, when he learned that night that he was one of the children chosen by a couple, the Learys. Had he noticed a woman and man looking at him, maybe even smiling at him? Maybe. But the afternoon had passed, as most did, in a haze, and even on the bus ride home, he had begun the work of forgetting it. He would spend a probationary weekend, the weekend before Thanksgiving, with the Learys, so they could see how they liked each other. That Thursday he was driven to their house by a counselor named Boyd, who taught shop and plumbing, and whom he didn't know very well. He knew Boyd knew what some of the other counselors did to him, and although he never stopped them, he never participated either. But as he was getting out of the car in the Learys' driveway, a one-story brick house surrounded on all sides by fallow, dark fields, Boyd snatched his forearm and pulled him close, startling him into alertness. "Don't fuck this up, St. Francis," he said. "This is your chance, do you hear me?"
"Yes, sir," he'd said.
"Go on, then," said Boyd, and released him, and he walked toward Mrs. Leary, who was standing in the doorway. Mrs. Leary was fat, but her husband was simply big, with large, red hands that looked like weaponry. They had two daughters, both in their 20s, and both married, and they thought it might be nice to have a boy in the house, someone who could help Mr. Leary, who repaired large-scale farm machinery and also farmed himself, with the field work. They chose him, they said, because he seemed quiet and polite, and they didn't want someone rowdy. They wanted someone hard-working, someone who would appreciate what having a home and a house meant. They had read in the binder that he knew how to work and how to clean, and that he did well on the home's farm. "Now, your name, that's an unusual name," Mrs. Leary said. He had never thought it unusual, but...
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
"What would you think of maybe going by a different name?" Mrs. Leary asked. "Like Cody, maybe? I've always liked the name Cody. It's a little less, well, it's a little more us, really." "I like Cody," he said, although he didn't really have an opinion about it. Jude, Cody, it didn't matter to him what he was called.
"Well, good," said Mrs. Leary.
That night, alone, he said the name aloud to himself. Cody Leary. Cody Leary. Could it be possible that he was entering this house as one person and then, as if the place were enchanted, transformed into another? Was it that simple, that fast? Gone would be Jude St. Francis, and with him, Brother Luke and Brother Peter and Father Gabriel, and the monastery and the counselors at the home, and his shame and fears and filth, and in his place would be Cody Leary, who would have parents and a room of his own, and would be able to make himself into whomever he chose. The rest of the weekend passed uneventfully, so uneventfully that with each day, with each hour, he could feel pieces of himself awaken, could feel the clouds that he gathered around himself separate and vanish, could feel himself seeing into the future and imagining the place in it he might have. He tried his hardest to be polite and hard-working, and it wasn't difficult. He got up early in the morning and made breakfast for the Learys, Mrs. Leary praising him so loudly and extravagantly that he had smiled, embarrassed, at the floor, and cleaned dishes, and helped Mr. Leary degrease his tools and rewire a lamp, and although there were events he didn't care for, the boring church service they attended on Sunday, the prayers they supervised before he was allowed to go to bed, they were hardly worse than the things he didn't like about the home. They were things he knew he could do without appearing resentful or ungrateful. The Learys, he could sense, would not be the sort of people who would behave the way that parents in books would, the way parents he yearned for might. But he knew how to be industrious. He knew how to keep them satisfied. He was still frightened of Mr. Leary's large red hands, and when he was left alone with him in the barn, He was shivery and watchful, but at least there was only Mr. Leary to fear, not a whole group of Mr. Learys, as there had been before, or there were at the home. When Boyd picked him up Sunday evening, he was pleased with how he'd done, confident even. "How'd it go?" Boyd asked him, and he was able to answer, honestly, "Good." He was certain, from Mrs. Leary's last words to him, "I have a feeling we'll be seeing much more of you very soon, Cody," that they would call on Monday, and that soon, maybe even by Friday, he would be Cody Leary, and the home would be one more place he'd put behind him. But then Monday passed, and then Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then it was the following week, and he wasn't called to the headmaster's office, and his letter to the Learys had gone unanswered, and every day the driveway to the dormitory remained a long, blank stretch, and no one came to get him. Finally, 2 weeks after the visit, he went to see Boyd at his workshop, where he knew he stayed late on Thursday nights. He waded through dinner out in the cold, the snow crunching under his feet, until he finally saw Boyd walking out the door.
"Christ," Boyd said when he saw him, nearly stepping on him as he turned. "Shouldn't you be back in the dorm, St. Francis?"
"Please," he begged. "Please tell me, are the Learys coming to get me?"
But he knew what the answer was even before he saw Boyd's face. "They changed their minds," said Boyd, and although he wasn't known by the counselors or the boys for his gentleness, he was almost gentle then. "It's over, St. Francis. It's not going to happen." He reached out a hand toward him, but he ducked, and Boyd shook his head and began walking off.
"Wait,"
he called, recovering himself and running as well as he could through the snow after Boyd.
"Let me try again," he said. "Tell me what I did wrong, and I'll try again."
He could feel the old hysteria descending upon him, could feel inside him the vestiges of the boy who would throw fits and shout, who could still a room with his screams. But Boyd shook his head again.
"It doesn't work like that, St. Francis," he said, and then he stopped and looked directly at him.
"Look," he said, "in a few years you'll be out of here. I know it seems like a long time, but it's not. And then you'll be an adult, and you'll be able to do whatever you want. You just have to get through these years."
And then he turned again, definitively, and stalked away from him.
"How?"
he yelled after Boyd.
"Boyd, tell me how! How, Boyd, how?"
Forgetting that he was to call him Sir and not Boyd. That night he had his first tantrum in years, and although the punishment here was the same, more or less, as it had been at the monastery, the release, the sense of flight it had once given him, was not. Now he was someone who knew better, whose screams would change nothing, and all his shouting did was bring him back to himself, so that everything, every hurt, every insult, felt sharper and brighter and stickier and more resonant than ever before. He would never, never know what he had done wrong that weekend at the Learys. He would never know if it had been something he could control or something he couldn't. And of all the things from the monastery, from the home, that he worked to scrub over, he worked hardest at forgetting that weekend, at forgetting the special shame of allowing himself to believe that he might be someone he knew he wasn't. But now, of course, with the court date 6 weeks, 5 weeks, 4 weeks away, he thought of it constantly. With Willem gone, and no one to monitor his hours and activities, he stayed up until the sun began lightening the sky, cleaning, scrubbing with a toothbrush the space beneath the refrigerator, bleaching each skinny grout canal between the bathtub wall tiles. He cleaned so he wouldn't cut himself, because he was cutting himself so much that even he knew how crazy, how destructive he was being. Even he was scared of himself, as much by what he was doing as by his inability to control it. He had begun a new method of balancing the edge of the blade on his skin and then pressing down, as deep as he could,
so that when he withdrew the razor, stuck like an axe head into a tree stump, there was half a second in which he could pull apart the two sides of flesh and see only a clean, white gouge, like a side of fatted bacon, before the blood began rushing in to pool within the cut. He felt dizzy, as if his body was pumped with helium. Food tasted like rot to him, and he stopped eating unless he had to. He stayed at the office until the night shift of cleaners began moving through the hallways, noisy as mice, and then stayed awake at home. He woke with his heart thudding so fast that he had to gulp air to calm himself. It was only work and Willem's calls that forced him into normalcy, or he'd have never left the house, would have cut himself until he could have loosed whole pyramids of flesh from his arms and flushed them down the drain. He had a vision in which he carved away at himself, first arms, then legs, then chest and neck and face, until he was only bones, a skeleton who moved and sighed and breathed and tottered through life on its porous, brittle stalks. He was back to seeing Andy every 6 weeks, and had delayed his most recent visit twice because he dreaded what Andy might say. But finally, a little less than 4 weeks before the court date, he went uptown and sat in one of the examining rooms until Andy peered in to say he was running late. "Take your time," he said. Andy studied him, squinting a bit. "I won't be long," he said finally, and then was gone. A few minutes later, his nurse, Callie, came in.
"Hi, Jude," she said. "Doctor wants me to get your weight. Do you mind stepping on the scale?"
He didn't want to, but he knew it wasn't Callie's fault or decision, and so he dragged himself off the table and onto the scale and didn't look at the number as Callie wrote it down in his chart and thanked him and left the room. "So," Andy said after he'd come in, studying his chart, "what should we talk about first, your extreme weight loss or your excessive cutting?" He didn't know what to say to that.
"Why do you think I've been cutting myself excessively?"
"I can always tell," Andy said. "You get sort of bluish under the eyes. You're probably not even conscious of it, and you're wearing your sweater over the gown. Whenever it's bad, you do that." "Oh," he said. He hadn't been aware. They were quiet, and Andy pulled his stool close to the table and asked, "When's the date?"
"February 15th.
"Ah," said Andy. "Soon."
"Yes."
"What are you worried about?"
"I'm worried,"
he began, and then stopped and tried again.
"I'm worried that if Harold finds out what I really am, he won't want to—"
He stopped.
"And I don't know which is worse, him finding out before, which means this definitely won't happen, or him finding out after and realizing I've deceived him."
He sighed. He hadn't been able to articulate this until now, but having done so, he knew that this was his fear. "Jude," Andy said, carefully, "what do you think is so bad about yourself that he wouldn't want to adopt you?"
"Andy," he pled, "don't make me say it. But I honestly don't know. The things I've done," he said, "the diseases I have from them."
He stumbled on, hating himself.
"It's disgusting. I'm disgusting."
"Jude," Andy began, and as he spoke, he paused between every few words, and he could feel Andy picking his way across a mine-pocked lawn, so deliberately and slowly was he going. "You were a kid, a baby. Those things were done to you. You have nothing, nothing to blame yourself for. Not ever. Not in any universe." Andy looked at him. "And even if you hadn't been a kid, even if you had just been some horny guy who wanted to fuck everything in sight and had ended up with a bunch of STDs, it still wouldn't be anything to be ashamed of." He sighed. "Can you try to believe me?"
He shook his head.
"I don't know." "I know," Andy said. They were quiet.
I wish you'd see a therapist, Jude, he added, and his voice was sad. He couldn't respond, and after a few minutes, Andy stood up. Well, he said, sounding determined, let's see them. And he took off his sweater and held out his arms. He could tell by Andy's expression that it was worse than he had anticipated, and when he looked down and tried to view himself as something unfamiliar, he could see in flashes what Andy did. The gobs of bandages applied at intervals to the fresh cuts, the half-healed cuts, with their fragile stitchings and still forming scar tissue, the one infected cut, which had developed a chunky cap of dried pus. So, Andy said after a long silence, after he'd almost finished his right arm, cleaning out the infected cut and painting antibiotic cream on the others. What about your extreme weight loss? I don't think it's extreme. Jude, said Andy, 12 pounds in not quite 8 weeks is extreme, and you didn't exactly have 12 pounds to spare to begin with. I'm just not hungry, he said finally. Andy didn't say anything else until he finished both his arms, and then sighed and sat down again and started scribbling on his pad. I want you to eat 3 full meals a day, Jude, he said, plus one of the things on this list, every day. That's in addition to standard meals, do you understand me? Or I'm going to call your crew and make them sit with you every mealtime and watch you eat, and you don't want that, believe me. He ripped the page off the pad and handed it to him. And then I want you back here next week. No excuses. He looked at the list. Peanut butter sandwich, cheese sandwich, avocado sandwich, 3 eggs with yolks, banana smoothie, and tucked it into his pants pocket. And the other thing I want you to do is this, said Andy. When you wake up in the middle of the night and want to cut yourself, I want you to call me instead. I don't care what time it is, you call me, okay? He nodded. I mean it, Jude. I'm sorry, Andy, he said. I know you are, said Andy. But you don't need to be sorry. Not to me, anyway. To Harold, he said. No, Andy corrected. Not to Harold either. Just to yourself. He went home and ate away at a banana until it turned to dirt in his mouth, and then changed and continued washing the living room windows, which he had begun the night before. He rubbed at them, inching the sofa closer so he could stand atop one of its arms, ignoring the twinges in his back as he climbed up and down, lugging the bucket of dirtied gray water slowly to the tub. After he'd finished the living room and Willem's room, he was in so much pain that he had to crawl to the bathroom. And after cutting himself, he rested, holding his arm above his head and wrapping the mat about him. When his phone rang, he sat up, disoriented, before groaningly moving to his bedroom, where the clock read 3 a.m., and listening to a very cranky, but alert, Andy. I called too late, Andy guessed. He didn't say anything. Listen, Jude, Andy continued. You don't stop this, and I really am going to have you committed. And I'll call Harold and tell him why. You can count on it. He paused. And besides which, he added, aren't you tired, Jude? You don't have to do this to yourself, you know. You don't need to. He didn't know what it was. Maybe it was just the calmness of Andy's voice, the steadiness with which he made his promise that made him realize that he was serious this time in a way he hadn't been before. Or maybe it was just the realization that, yes, he was tired. So tired that he was willing, finally, to accept someone else's orders. But over the next week, he did as he was told. He ate his meals, even as the food transformed itself by some strange alchemy to mud, to offal. He made himself chew and swallow, chew and swallow. They weren't big meals, but they were meals. Andy called every night at midnight, and Willem called every morning at 6. He couldn't bring himself to ask,
and Willem never volunteered whether Andy had contacted him. The hours in between were the most difficult, and although he couldn't cease cutting himself entirely, he did limit it. 2 cuts, and he stopped. In the absence of cutting, he felt himself being tugged toward earlier punishments. Before he had been taught to cut himself, there was a period in which he would toss himself against the wall outside the motel room he shared with Brother Luke again and again, until he sagged, exhausted, to the ground, and his left side was permanently stained blue and purple and brown with bruises. He didn't do that now, but he remembered the sensation, the satisfying slam of his body against the wall, the awful pleasure of hurling himself against something so immovable. On Friday, he saw Andy, who wasn't approving. He hadn't gained any weight, but also didn't lecture him, nor had he lost any, and the next day he flew to Boston. He didn't tell anyone he was going, not even Harold. Julia, he knew, was at a conference in Costa Rica, but Harold, he knew, would be home. Julia had given him a set of keys 6 years ago when he was arriving for Thanksgiving at a time when both she and Harold happened to have department meetings, so he let himself into the house and poured a glass of water, looking out the back garden as he drank. It was just before noon, and Harold would still be at his tennis game, so he went to the living room to wait for him. But he fell asleep, and when he woke, it was to Harold shaking his shoulder and urgently repeating his name. "Harold," he said, sitting up.
I'm sorry. I should have called."
"Jesus," Harold said, panting. He smelled cold and sharp.
"Are you all right, Jude? What's wrong?"
Nothing, he said, hearing before he said it how absurd his explanation was.
"I just thought I'd stop by."
"Well," said Harold, momentarily silent, "it's good to see you." He sat in his chair and looked at him. "You've been something of a stranger these past few weeks."
"I know," he said. "I'm sorry."
Harold shrugged. "No apologies necessary. I'm just glad you're okay."
"Yes," he said. "I'm okay."
Harold tilted his head. "You don't look too good." He smiled.
"I've had the flu."
He gazed up at the ceiling, as if his lines might be written there. "The Forsythia is falling down, you know."
"I know. It's been a windy winter."
"I'll help you stake it if you want." Harold looked at him for a long moment then, his mouth slightly moving, as if he was both trying and not trying to speak. Finally, he said,
"Yeah, let's go do that."
Outside, it was abruptly, insultingly cold, and both of them began sniffling. He positioned the stake and Harold hammered it into the ground. Although the earth was frozen and chipped up into pottery-like shards as he did. After they'd gotten it deep enough, Harold handed him lengths of twine, and he tied the center stalks of the bush to the stake, snugly enough so that they'd be secure, but not so snug that they'd be constricted. He worked slowly, making sure the knots were tight, snapping off a few branches that were too bent to recover.
"Harold," he said, when he was halfway down the bush, "I wanted to talk to you about something, but I don't know where to begin."
"Stupid," he told himself.
"This is such a stupid idea. You were so stupid to think any of this could ever happen."
He opened his mouth to continue, and then shut it, and then opened it again. He was a fish, dumbly blowing bubbles, and he wished he had never come, had never begun speaking.
"Jude," said Harold. "Tell me. Whatever it is."
He stopped.
"Are you having second thoughts?"
"No," he said. "No, nothing like that." They were silent.
"Are you?"
"No, of course not." He finished the last tie and brought himself to his feet, Harold deliberately not helping him.
"I don't want to tell you this," he said,
and looked down at the Forsythia, its bare, twiggy ugliness.
but I have to because I don't want to be deceitful with you. But Harold, I think you think I'm one kind of person, and I'm not.
Harold was quiet. What kind of person do I think you are?
A good person, he said. Someone decent.
Well, said Harold, you're right. I do.
But I'm not,
he said, and could feel his eyes grow hot, despite the cold.
I've done things that good people don't do,
he continued, lamely.
And I just think you should know that about me, that I've done terrible things, things I'm ashamed of, and if you knew, you'd be ashamed to know me, much less be related to me.
Jude, Harold said at last, I can't imagine anything you might have done that would change the way I feel about you. I don't care what you did before. Or rather, I do care. I would love to hear about your life before we met. But I've always had the feeling, the very strong feeling, that you never wanted to discuss it. He stopped and waited. Do you want to discuss it now? Do you want to tell me? He shook his head. He wanted to and didn't want to, both.
I can't, he said.
Beneath the small of his back, he felt the first unfurlings of discomfort, a blackened seed spreading its thorned branches.
Not now,
he begged himself.
Not now.
A plea as impossible as the plea he really meant.
Not now. Not ever.
Well, Harold sighed, in the absence of specifics, I won't be able to reassure you specifically, so I'm just going to give you a blanket, all-encompassing reassurance, which I hope you'll believe.
Jude, whatever it is, whatever you did, I promise you, whether you someday tell me or not, that it will never make me regret wanting or having you as a member of my family.
He took a deep breath, held his right hand before him. Jude St. Francis, as your future parent, I hereby absolve you of everything for which you seek absolution. And was this what he in fact wanted? Absolution? He looked at Harold's face, so familiar he could remember its every furrow when he closed his eyes, and which, despite the flourishes and formality of his declaration, was serious and unsmiling. Could he believe Harold? The hardest thing is not finding the knowledge, Brother Luke once said to him, after he'd confessed that he was having difficulty believing in God. The hardest thing is believing it. He felt he had failed once again, failed to confess properly, failed to determine in advance what he wanted to hear in response. Wouldn't it have been easier in a way if Harold had told him that he was right, that they should perhaps rethink the adoption? He would have been devastated, of course, but it would have been an old sensation, something he understood. In Harold's refusal to let him go lay a future he couldn't imagine, one in which someone might really want him for good. And that was a reality that he had never experienced before, for which he had no preparation, no signposts. Harold would lead and he would follow, until one day he would wake and Harold would be gone, and he would be left vulnerable and stranded in a foreign land with no one there to guide him home. Harold was waiting for his reply, but the pain was now unignorable, and he knew he had to rest.
Harold, he said, I'm sorry, but I think I'd better go lie down for a while.
Go, said Harold, unoffended. Go.
In his room, he lies down atop the comforter and closes his eyes, but even after the episode ends, he's exhausted, and tells himself he'll nap for just a few minutes and then get up again and see what Harold has in the house. If he has brown sugar, he'll bake something. There was a bowl of persimmons in the kitchen, and maybe he'll make a persimmon cake. But he doesn't wake up. Not when Harold comes back to check on him in the next hour and places the back of his hand against his cheek
and then drapes a blanket over him. Not when Harold checks on him again, right before dinner. He sleeps through his phone ringing at midnight, and again at 6 a.m., and through the house phone ringing at 12:30 and then at 6:30, and Harold's conversations with first Andy and then Willem. He sleeps into the morning and through lunch, and only wakes when he feels Harold's hand on his shoulder and hears Harold saying his name, telling him his flight's leaving in a few hours. Before he wakes, he dreams of a man standing in a field. He can't see the man's features, but he is tall and thin, and he's helping another older man hitch the hulk of a tractor carapace to the back of a truck. He knows he's in Montana from the whitened, curved bowl vastness of the sky and from the particular kind of cold there, which is completely without moisture and which feels somehow purer than cold he's felt anywhere else. He still can't see the man's features, but he thinks he knows who he is, recognizes his long strides and his way of crossing his arms in front of him as he listens to the other man. "Cody," he calls out in his dream, and the man turns, but he's too far away, and so he can't quite tell if, under the brim of the man's baseball cap, they share the same face. The 15th is a Friday, which he takes off from work. There had been some talk of a dinner party on Thursday night, but in the end they settle on an early lunch the day of the ceremony, as J.B. calls it. Their court appointment is at 10, and after it's over, everyone will come back to the house to eat. Harold had wanted to call a caterer, but he insisted he'd cook, and he spends the remains of Thursday evening in the kitchen. He does the baking that night, the chocolate walnut cake Harold likes, the tart tatin Julia likes, the sourdough bread they both like, and picks through 10 pounds of crab and mixes the meat with egg and onion and parsley and breadcrumbs and forms them into patties. He cleans the potatoes and gives the carrots a quick scrub and chops the ends off the Brussels sprouts so that the next day all he'll have to do is toss them in oil and shove them into the oven. He shakes the cartons of figs into a bowl, which he'll roast and serve over ice cream topped with honey and balsamic vinaigrette. They are all of Harold and Julia's favorite dishes, and he is glad to make them, glad to have something to give them, however small. Throughout the evening, Harold and Julia wander in and out, and although he tells them not to, they wash dishes and pans as he dirties them, pour him glasses of water and wine, and ask if they can help him, even though he tells them they should relax. Finally, they leave for bed, and although he promises them that he will as well, he instead stays up, the kitchen bright and silent around him, singing quietly, his hands moving to keep the mania at bay. The past few days have been very difficult, some of the most difficult he can remember. So difficult that one night he even called Andy after their midnight check-in, and when Andy offered to meet him at a diner at 2 a.m., he accepted the offer and went, desperate to get himself out of the apartment, which suddenly seemed full of irresistible temptations. Razors, of course, but also knives and scissors and matches and staircases to throw himself down. He knows that if he goes to his room now, he won't be able to stop himself from heading directly to the bathroom, where he has long kept a bag, its contents identical to the one at Lispenard Street, taped to the sink's undercarriage. His arms ache with yearning, and he is determined not to give in. He has both dough and batter left over, and decides he'll make a tart with pine nuts and cranberries, and maybe a round, flat cake glazed with slices of oranges and honey. By the time both are done baking, it will almost be daylight, and he will be past danger and will have successfully saved himself. Malcolm and J.B. will both be at the courthouse the next day. They're taking the morning flight. But Willem, who was supposed to be there, won't. He called the week before to say filming had been delayed, and now he'll be coming home on the 18th, not the 14th. He knows there's nothing to be done about this, but still he mourns Willem's absence almost fiercely. A day like this without Willem
Won't be a day at all.
Call me the second it's over, Willem had said. It's killing me I can't be there.
He did, however, invite Andy in one of their midnight conversations, which he grew to enjoy. In those talks, they discussed everyday things, calming things, normal things, the new Supreme Court justice nominee, the most recent health care bill. He approved of it, Andy didn't. A biography of Rosalind Franklin they'd both read. He liked it, Andy didn't. The apartment that Andy and Jane were renovating. He liked the novelty of hearing Andy say, with real outrage,
"Jude, you've got to be fucking kidding me,"
which he was used to hearing when being confronted about his cutting or his amateurish bandaging skills, instead applied to his opinions about movies and the mayor and books and even paint colors. Once he learned that Andy wouldn't use their talks as an occasion to reprimand him or lecture him, he relaxed into them and even managed to learn some more things about Andy himself. Andy spoke of his twin, Beckett, also a doctor, a heart surgeon, who lived in San Francisco and whose boyfriend Andy hated and was scheming to get Beckett to dump, and how Jane's parents were giving them their house on Shelter Island, and how Andy had been on the football team in high school, the very Americanness of which had made his parents uneasy, and how he had spent his junior year abroad in Siena, where he dated a girl from Lucca and gained 20 pounds. It wasn't that he and Andy never spoke of Andy's personal life. They did to some extent after every appointment, but on the phone he talked more, and he was able to pretend that Andy was only his friend and not his doctor, despite the fact that this illusion was belied by the call's very premise.
"Obviously you shouldn't feel obligated to come," he added, hastily, after inviting Andy to the court date.
"I'd love to come," Andy said. "I was wondering when I'd be invited." Then he felt bad.
"I just didn't want you to feel you had to spend even more time with your weird patient who already makes your life so difficult," he said.
"You're not just my weird patient, Jude," Andy said. "You're also my weird friend." He paused. "Or at least I hope you are." He smiled into the phone.
"Of course I am," he said. "I'm honored to be your weird friend."
And so Andy was coming as well. He'd fly back that afternoon, but Malcolm and JB would spend the night, and they'd all leave together on Saturday. Upon arriving, he had been surprised and then moved to see how thoroughly Harold and Julia had cleaned the house and how proud they were of the work they'd done. "Look," one of the other kept saying, triumphantly pointing at a surface, a table, a chair, a corner of floor, that would normally have been obscured by stacks of books or journals, but which was now clear of all clutter. There were flowers everywhere, winter flowers, bunches of decorative cabbages and white-budded dogwood branches and paper-white bulbs with their sweet, faintly fecal fragrance, and the books in their cases had been straightened, and even the nap on the sofa had been repaired.
"And look at this, Jude," Julia had said, linking her arm through his and showing him the celadon glazed dish on the hallway table,
which had been broken for as long as he'd known them, the shards that had snapped off its side permanently nested in the bowl and furred with dust. But now it had been fixed and washed and polished.
"Wow,"
he said, when presented with each new thing, grinning idiotically, happy because they were so happy. He didn't care. He never had, whether their place was clean or not. They could have lived surrounded by ionic columns of old New York Times, with colonies of rats squeaking plumply underfoot for all he cared. But he knew they thought he minded, and had mistaken his incessant, tedious cleaning of everything as a rebuke, as much as he'd tried and tried to assure them it wasn't. He cleaned now to stop himself, to distract himself from doing other things, but when he was in college, he had cleaned for the others to express his gratitude. It was something he could do and had always done, and they gave him so much, and he gave them so little. JB, who enjoyed living in squalor, never noticed. Malcolm, who had grown up with a housekeeper, always noticed and always thanked him. Only Willem hadn't liked it.
Stop it, Jude, he'd said one day, grabbing his wrist as he picked JB's dirty shirts off the floor. You're not our maid. But he hadn't been able to stop. Not then.